WHIVLP New Orleans 102.3. You are listening to Good Morning Comrade. You can check us out every Tuesday right here on 102.3 FM. You can also check us out online, whivfm.org/listen. More information on our website, goodmorningcomrade.com. So today, on the Zoom studio, I'm used to saying in the studio, but like I'm never in the studio anymore. But we have returning champion, Connor Lewis. Connor is one of my co-hosts on the show Union Thoughts, along with Diana Hussein. You can check that out every week, unionthoughts.com on all the platforms. You can also, we also have Elizabeth Jeffers, who is a professor of education policy. How y'all doing?
We're doing great.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Absolutely wonderful.
Absolutely wonderful. Love to hear it. Love to hear it. And especially after what we are all just kind of like reading together, which is a little document from an organization called the American Enterprise Institute. And guess what, folks? They have got a plan to reopen our schools. Isn't that exciting?
I mean, the reason I say that I'm wonderful is because I don't want anyone to think that I'm mad, because this is funny to me, actually. Like, reading this document is funny. Don't tell
it's
anyone
scary.
That I'm
mad. It's actually scary. It's very frightening. It you know, they definitely have a plan. And I've been saying since day one, you know, opportunist and white supremacist. And I will say that, you know, some of the conservative think tanks that are funding this, you know, are aligned with these white militia groups, you know, that are storming, you know, Michigan's capital. Mm-hmm. I think there's a definite connection. I think we need to do some research in terms of like following the money. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I've been saying that from the start. You know, this is when these powers that be, you know, they take advantage of crisis, of a disaster. And we've experienced this in New Orleans. So we know this story quite well.
And so I guess to kind of like kick us off, first off, are either of you familiar with the American Enterprise Institute? Have you, what is it? And like, what is their outlook on the world, I suppose?
Unfortunately, yes. I mean, they're part of the kind of big kind of, I think some people have called it kind of like the Coke-topus, mm-hmm. The kind of network of Coke-funded and just generally right-wing think tanks. Mm-hmm. The AEI goes back a little bit further than a lot of those, actually dates back about, I think, 80-something years, whereas the Koch brothers really became politically active more in like the 1970s and onward. But it's still part of that whole kind of sphere of right-wing think tanks, infrastructure, mm-hmm. Very similar to the State Policy Network, which of course is actually a Koch front group. Mm-hmm. And so they're trying to give basically intellectual legitimacy to really what when they were founded were really kind of fringe right-wing ideas that even the Republican Party of the time had kind of pushed to the side, and which unfortunately are now basically the political mainstream.
Oh, they're driving right now. The American Enterprise Institute just drives the government at this point.
Right. Which,
well,
you know,
I mean, Betsy DeVos's husband is on their board, right?
Yeah, he's Dick DeVos. Great name, by the way. Very appropriate. But he is on the board of the American Enterprise Institute, along with folks from, I have their information up right in front of me. The Carlyle Group, a bunch of capital management firms. Oh, Molson Coors Brewing Company. How about that?
Oh yeah, Coors is like notoriously like right wing.
Yeah, anti-union, very anti-union. Yeah. Let's see.
Hannah Scandera from New Mexico, who was, you know, she ran a free market right wing think tank called Rio Grande Foundation. And they really pushed the wave of teacher evaluation reforms.
Oh, my
that
favorite.
We saw in Race to the Top legislation, as well as in Louisiana with Act One and whatnot, like in 2012.
Yeah.
She was required to pass these things to get the Race to the Top funding. But, you know, she was hurt. Yeah.
Yeah, and she's one of the authors of this study, along with our great, wonderful friend John White in Louisiana. Elizabeth, can you please explain to our friend Connor and perhaps to our audience who John White is, and what is his history in education in Louisiana?
Well, I ran into John White when I was a teacher at John McDonough High School. He came here first as the Recovery School District superintendent, which was primarily based in Orleans Parish, you know, to take over our schools. So he came down to replace Paul Vallis.
Right.
Yes. Favorite person again.
Thumbs down for Paul Vallis, too, by the way.
So, yeah, he came, but within a year, he became, John White became the state superintendent. He's a former Teach for America teacher who got involved in policy. I want to say he was involved with some policy in New York City with Joe Klein. We had a run-in when I was working with the John McDonough Steering Committee. Mm-hmm. And we just wanted the school to be able to, they had done such a horrible job with these charter networks, mm-hmm. brought the school performance score down so far down to a single digit. And they brought in Oprah Winfrey and they did such a horrible job. They did the TV, the TV show with the children and put out their personal, but anyway, so they had done such a horrible job, the Recovery School District. So we were just a group of educators, researchers, former administrators, parents, neighbors, pastors, who were trying to get John McDonough back to local control.
Right, from the charters.
Everything we did. Well, it was under the Recovery School District.
Yeah, RSD.
So we wanted it to be run as a direct run mm-hmm. public school, and that was our demand.
Right.
As a community-based school. But, so John White, you know, and some of our Bessie board representative, they just, you know, they were really against what we were doing and shut it down, as well as James Garvey. So we had two Bessie members who were no longer with us. Mm-hmm. When they ran for re-election, they were they had people that, you know, were very well funded, and they made sure Lottie Beebe and Carolyn Hill? Yeah, they were no longer. But anyway, so John White is a part of this whole major, you know, national reform movement. And it's been very well funded. He has
associated with Arne Duncan, who was the Secretary of Education during the Obama administration, and also connected to some of these more. Arne Duncan just largely was a, you know, destructor of public education in the U.S. And also another one of the authors in here was connected to him. Anyway, let's start to talk about what is in this document. So they have a plan to open our schools back up. What's their plan?
So what's the plan as they describe it, or what's actually the plan? Because they're two very different things. I mean, this is all couched in just very, very reasonable sounding language. But if you know anything about AEI and the associated groups and what they're pushing, and I mean, simply knowing that Betsy DeVos's husband is on the board tells you a lot. I mean, realistically, this is just a wish list of all of the quote unquote education reform nonsense that these groups have been pushing yeah. for years, and now they see an opportunity to actually make it out as though they're actually looking out for public education and for the welfare of, you know, students and communities. It's all crap. Yeah. I mean, it's the mention
very yeah. frightening things in it. I would say the first thing that stood out with me is you know, and it reminds me of the legislation that last week, the Republican legislators were trying to pass to undo John Bel Edwards when he extended the stay-at-home order on May 1st. And that next Monday, they started meeting again, and they wanted to undo his legislation for the stay-at-home order. Because it says governors, not federal officials, have authority and responsibility for enacting and relaxing social distancing measures, including the conditions under which schools should reopen, But basically it's saying that, and then it goes to say that the schools and those closest to the students should have pretty much autonomy. It says, hold on.
Yeah, it says.
Yeah, so that scares me because what we have in New Orleans, you know, after we started demanding for the return of John McDonough, and because we had 107 schools taken over by the state, and that was, people were upset about that because it was done in a very undemocratic way after Katrina, they pushed in this legislation. So people, you know, communities were demanding to have the schools return back to our local school board. And so they developed this. At first, it was Dr. Bowie. He put out legislation 166, which was for the immediate return of these schools that were, quote unquote, no longer labeled as failing. But so then the next year, Karen Carter Peterson, supported by some of these, you know, big charter organizations, put out a bill called Act, which became Act 91. And Act 91 said the schools will go back, but basically they'll go back our way. So, you know, Caroline Romer, you know, spoke up. Ben Cleven from New Orleans College Prep, they spoke in support of this Act 91, whereas Justice and Beyond Coalition, different community groups, you know, they were supportive of Joe Bowie's bill, which is the original bill for school return to the local governance. So it was basically, we want the schools to go back, but we want them to go our way, where we have total autonomy over the funding, we have total autonomy over the hiring, firing, we have total autonomy over, you know, certification issues, over curriculum, over schedules, over calendars, you know,
we don't need contracts. No freaking school district.
Right. So your school district is just these, you know, they you took away all the power from them. So these schools came back, I believe, as type 3B charters. And so when it's saying that, you know, basically the charters, well, it says LEAs. Now, mind you, when these schools came back to Orleans Parish, they became their own, well, they already were their own local education agency, just like Jefferson Parish School Board is a local education agency.
Let's freeze right there. A local education association, a local education, what was it, LEA?
Yeah, so you have your state education. So this is how the money travels. Mm-hmm. So, you know, let's just say, okay, so how much money came down here? $287 million came down to the state of Louisiana through the CARES Act.
Mm-hmm.
$287 million came to the Louisiana Department of Education. So they've already distributed $260 million. So the money is sent to the SEAs, the state education agencies. And then those SEAs distribute the money to the LEAs, which are the local education agencies. Mm-hmm. So KIPP is its own LEA. Mm-hmm. Renew is its own LEA, okay?
These are charter
Inspire
networks.
NOLA is its own LEA, mm-hmm. okay? Just like they're their own, right? But these are non-elected school board representatives.
Right, and they have, so this is something that's interesting for a whole field of reasons, because that has implications, though, this sort of like pushing off and these breaking up of these educational agencies, as you put it, these local education agencies. So if you have an Orleans Parish School Board, which we have once again, but if they have a contract, for example, with the United Teachers of New Orleans, which they did prior to Katrina, and then you have a local education or one of these charter networks who's their own discrete LEA, then the collective bargaining contract that the United Teachers of New Orleans has with the school district, Orleans Parish, does not necessarily apply to this other entity. Is that correct?
Correct.
So essentially, one of the, you know, whether intended or not, effects of this is that it has the effect of breaking up collective bargaining in unions. This is a sort of like glorified union busting operation amongst other things.
Yeah.
And one of the ways that you can really tell that there's an implicit attack on unions is there's a lot of what I'll say kind of disingenuous gestures toward, oh, of course, we need to include union leaders in these discussions. But there's a specific section in this document that says about collective bargaining agreements that basically, yeah, you're going to need to waive those.
Yeah.
You're going to need to waive any part of those that's inconvenient, which is falling into this familiar framework that collective bargaining agreements are inflexible. They impede things that need to be done, et cetera, et cetera. The reality on the ground is that local associations and unions are working with school administrators to adapt where appropriate and to push back where administrators are really utilizing this. This is basically a way to push things that aren't in the best interests of the community or staff, mm-hmm. which unfortunately, I mean, it shouldn't be a shock to most people, but there are definitely administrators out there that are doing exactly that. Mm-hmm. And so the idea that one, collective bargaining agreements are the problem here is nonsense. And two, the idea that this kind of thing isn't already happening where appropriate is also nonsense. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's really just a way to weaken collective bargaining agreements, to weaken the rights of public school teachers. Mm-hmm. And one of the other ways that you can tell that that's really what's in the, you know, kind of the end goal here is that they also talk about weakening regulatory.
Right.
Yeah. The regulatory flexibility, mm-hmm. Which, you know, thinking about a lot of the regulations in Pennsylvania, for example, that apply to public education, those are incredibly important, not only for good educational provision, but also for student safety. Mm-hmm. And the idea that I could easily see regulatory flexibility being utilized you could translate that into the process a district needs to go through to subcontract out their cafeteria services, and we'll waive all the normal requirements because they need to cut costs.
Right. Exactly. So,
I mean, it's really just a Trojan horse for a whole lot of things that are going to privatize public education and weaken teachers' unions.
Yeah.
And weaken governance as well. So, you know, as someone in Orleans Parish, you know, if I'm a parent, have, you know, children in school, I can't, you know, my local school or my elected representative, you know, doesn't have autonomy. These charters have autonomy in their boards that may not reflect the demographic of the students. And there's research that shows that. But these are appointed charter boards. So that's scary.
Appointed by who?
I don't know. New Schools for New Orleans, maybe. I know they have a lot to do. I know they recommend board members. Mm-hmm. They've been really pushing that charter school that I get their emails need mm-hmm. to apply for these PPP, you know, funding. They need to Small Business Administration grants.
They get the money like Ruth Chris and Shake Shack too. Oh, okay. So they get the best of both worlds. They get to get CARES Act money for being a public entity, but they also get to have the same kind of small business benefits that so they get like a little bit of both. Is that what it sounds like?
And more than that, we already got our funding, our MFE funding on February 1st. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we're not paying for electricity. We're not, you know, we're not paying for a lot of things. So, mm-hmm. but we got the full funding for the full year already. So that's triple dipping.
Yeah. Wow. Must be nice.
What's really scary to me is this stuff about the school personnel, talking about how some educators may be vulnerable to COVID-19, raising questions about how to protect them. Meanwhile, districts and teachers unions should work together to revisit aspects of their labor agreements to help schools adapt to social distancing and to ensure that vulnerable teachers can work safely and productively.
What does that mean?
Yeah. Models evolve. Schools and districts must be prepared to evaluate their staffing needs. With vulnerable personnel, those over age 55 are the most at risk for COVID-19. Mm-hmm. This would suggest that an estimated 18% of teachers and 27% of principals are considered vulnerable. This is really scary. States should explore possibilities to offer early retirement or reassign at-risk staff.
So basically,
they created a new term.
So you can force retirement of teachers that are deemed to be at risk, and those are your veteran teachers for the most part, right? Your veteran school
and your union, Mm-hmm.
Union leaders often, are going to be more senior. I mean, and the other part of it is that realistically, I can tell you exactly why they're more interested than this. It's not about worker safety. It's about concern over their health insurance costs.
Right.
I mean, that's really what it
that's
is.
That's an excellent point.
Yeah. They don't want to, they don't want to pay
exactly
for that. They don't
want
to have to deal with that as a part of the, you know, insurance premiums going on. You know, what would make that, what's one big policy that would make all of that better? I wonder, I don't know. What if we had like Medicare for all or something? I don't know.
Or we could change the whole retirement plans and no longer do we have to pay into teachers' retirement system, at least Louisiana, because we're going to get these, we're going to lax our teacher certification requirements, which is what it says in here, that we may need to do that. And so these people may not even finish their degree that they bring in. So, of course, we don't need to put them into TRSL, right?
So more Teach for America?
Public retirement system. Mm-hmm.
More Teach NOLA, more Teach for America, more people that are coming in to sort of fill the, you know, forced shortage, I suppose, like the intentional shortage, I would argue, of teachers. Because there's this crisis that was generated, and it's obviously like that's the thing that really kind of
they are
blows
creating
my mind.
A crisis.
Well, that's the thing that really blows my mind, because all I ever hear about when it comes to we need to hire on more Teach for America, more Teach for America, more Teach for America, is because we are in a critical shortage of teachers right now. But then all of a sudden on the other side of it, it's, oh no, these older teachers, we need to get them home and away from schools because they're in danger. You know, it's like,
and there's also a racial component to this, because if you, you know, look at it, you know, in Black and Latino communities are being more impacted by this for a multitude of reasons that have been existing, systemic issues that have been existing for a long time.
Very long time.
It's been exposed. But so you know, you talk about the teachers that they're going to, I mean, I just, because I experienced after Katrina when our teaching force was laid off, which was 74% Black, and many retired veteran teachers and many others, you know, forced to retire, same type thing. And so then that's when you saw the TFAs coming in, and you know, it just caused a lot of problems in terms of the It was not in the best service of children. These were not educators, and they were foreign to New Orleans, you know, culture. And they, you know, these were the teachers we had multi-generational relationships with these communities.
They were part of the community.
You know, my cousin, my aunt, my sister, my brother, and now everybody's gone. So, you know, and administrators as well. So it wasn't just the teachers that were fired, it was the administrators. But it says right here, if vulnerable teachers cannot come to school to teach, schools will need to find other teachers who could quickly step in. Two workable strategies are to relax interstate licensure requirements and expedite certification for teachers whose training was interrupted this spring. So, yeah, I mean, yeah, I remember after Katrina and I was in Recovery School District when they gave $17,000 recruitment and retention stipend, $17,000 to people who came from out of state to come teach in New Orleans, which was particularly offensive because many New Orleans teachers, such as myself and many others, had come back, even though we had been laid off. We came back
and
to
you didn't
start
get
the
that stipend
for the children, and we did not get that. They gave us a few thousand dollars, but this was the FEMA money that came down to help, you know, to help these teachers restart the schools and restart their lives. And I believe it was given to the teachers in Jefferson Parish and or in St. Tammany and in St. Bernard Parish. Definitely St. Bernard and St. Tammany, they received that money for housing, you know, but we did not in New Orleans. It was given to, and the majority of the demographic of those teachers were white, which is highly problematic considering our student demographic, which is which has always been, for not always, but for a long time, been predominantly African American, and is larger Latino population now.
What do you think,
so, Connor? It just makes me think about all that.
What do you think when you see stuff like this, Connor? I mean, there's just a lot going on here.
Where do you want to start? Well, where do you want to start?
Start at the beginning.
I mean, thinking about how plans like this, you know, working in education first as educator now is on the union end, it's pretty clear what the game is here with all of this. And the frustrating thing, just reading through this document, is it's couched in all this language that sounds nice if you don't know exactly what it is that is between the lines.
Right.
One of the things that is particularly frustrating, I think, one, there's, I'll give a little bit of context. One of the major ideas that's bouncing around the Pennsylvania legislature right now is forcing local unions, or districts being able to force local unions, to reopen their collective bargaining agreements to force them to take wage cuts.
Oh, wow. Because part of the reason is because states are not able to collect taxes. Because right. so many things, like, people aren't going out and they're not doing the shopping. And they're not paying the state. Because I know in Louisiana, a huge percentage of our state's budget is collected, and local budgets as well, is collected in state and local income. I mean, not income taxes, sales taxes.
Right.
Which, when you don't have when you have people at home who are not going out and purchasing things at the stores, those taxes don't get added to those coffers.
Right. And, you know, I think that just thinking a little bit about that, and thinking about in Pennsylvania, it's very similar. About 60% on average of district revenue comes from local sources, primarily property taxes, but also earned income tax. And the remainder is all through state appropriation. And of course, Pennsylvania has been hit harder, as economically at least, than a lot of other states has been. I think that we have one of the highest unemployment rates in the country right now. And so there is a legitimate revenue problem that is going to hit local districts and hit states that they don't necessarily have a significant amount of ability to get out of. But the problem is that, and this document kind of gets back to it, that revenue problem is being passed on to the students, and it's being passed on to the teachers, forcing them to give back and to accept, you know, harm to their education, accept harm to their compensation, whatever it may be.
And their health.
And their health. And when the reality is, like, this document is setting up this kind of scenario in which, there's no question that, you know, there are going to be budget cuts. Mm-hmm. Like, there's no question. There's no way out of it. Well, yes, there is. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that, I think, is the frustrating thing.
There is a literal fire hose of money that is going directly into the pockets of giant corporations that are like that are just like, they're just drinking it up. They're just getting like grapes poured over them while they're laying on like one of those big loungers. they can get all of the funding that they ever would ever possibly could ever want and never ever actually need. But and plus they have the sort of like structure in terms of like the you know, publicly openly traded, so that they can raise money very easily, but they don't have to do that when they're getting Fed money they're literally getting Fed money fed to them. It's like it's calling it the Fed for that very reason.
But what scares me with thing is that it's more about this changing of the economic system.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. This whole free market, you know, it's so like, you know, if you read Naomi Klein's The Shock Doctrine, and it's almost like, okay, this isn't, they see it as, and you see this language in the report about like opportunity and chance, you know, and so the restructuring of the economy is what's, you know, bothersome. Mm-hmm. And also, like I said, that you're forcing these children to go back and have, you know, go in, you know, and be, expose themselves and the teachers as well. So it's either you go back to work or you
or if
you go back to working, you put your health at risk and you could die. Okay.
Or if you're too weak to do it, you will just make you retire.
And a lot of people are going to go back to work, you know, even though their health may be at risk, you know. And so it's just awful. It's sacrificing human lives, and particularly doing it around children and educators is, you know, those most vulnerable.
Yeah.
And the thing is, you know, none of this is actually about the providing a quality education for kids. The whole reason realistically behind this push to reopen schools is because it's part of reopening the economy. That's it. They want to provide childcare for people to go back to work. That's literally it. I mean, this is not about educational outcomes. This is not about actually making sure the kids are learning, that they have what they need to support them. This is about literally just about schools as they plug into the broader economy.
Yeah.
That's it. They just want to get the economy restarted at all costs.
You are listening to WHIV LP New Orleans 102.3. This show is called Good Morning Comrade. You can check us out online at goodmorningcomrade.com. That's a, you know, I'm glad that you brought that point up, Connor, because I think that we actually did talk about this on the show that we co-host together called called Union Thoughts. Check it out. Get some more information at unionthoughts.com. We're on all the things. But we talked specifically about the teachers' unions and how they have been approaching this returning to school sort of situation. So if either of you, either Elizabeth or Connor would like to comment on what the unions are doing right now, in light of this sort of like push to like reopen the economy, please, you know, fill me in on that.
Connor. Well, I think one of the things that's really important, that we're seeing from unions, and hopefully this is something that rank and file members, local unions really take seriously, is that both the National Education Association and the American Federation of Teachers, the two, pretty much the two only teachers unions in the United States that represent, I think between the two of them, about 4 million or so teachers, education support professionals, and higher education workers. I mean, they're signaling that any kind of return to regular instruction, whatever that means these days.
Ain't nothing regular right now.
Yeah, there's nothing regular about instruction now, and there isn't going to be for a while. But they're signaling pretty strongly that all of that needs to be guided by student safety, staff safety, and the community health. And they've pretty, there was an article in Politico about, I think, about a week ago, where both Lily Eskelsen-Garcia, the president of the NEA, and Randy Weingarten, the president of AFT, pretty much said that nothing is off the table in making sure that schools don't reopen before they're, before it's safe to do so. And Eskelsen-Garcia even pointed to the wave of teacher strikes starting in West Virginia and said, look, you know, strikes aren't off the table. And obviously that's new and militant, I think, but I think that's the moment we're in. And it's really interesting to see national union leaders signaling that, look, nothing's off the table right now.
Now, I do think that's interesting. Now, I think that part of that, the sort of like other side of that is making sure that that message that these leaders are signaling, as you said, kind of makes its way towards, you know, leadership of local and state unions and also to members. So I guess, you know, as a member, sort of rank and file member of AFT specifically, that's the union I'm in. What could, and either of y'all could talk about this and based on your experience, what could a rank and file member do with that kind of information, and how can they sort of like start working towards following that lead?
Well, I'm really inspired by the sanitation workers here. You know, they've been on strike. I don't know if they went back today or not. Of course,
they were out there.
They were still on strike today?
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, just the organizing that's been going around the country has been very inspiring. So I think it's, you know, the teachers really have to demand that.
Mm-hmm.
They have, like, it's if you don't, then, you know, and yeah, it's life or death, mm-hmm. essentially.
For so many people, it's for yourself and for your kids and it's for your families and it's for like a larger part of the economy.
They have to organize. Because I'm looking at this. This is CDC recommendations that they, I mean, I'm looking at this AEI document. Mm-hmm. I'm not looking at the CDC. But it's the CDC considerations for school closures. It says something like, if there's substantial community spread, implement multiple social distancing strategies for gatherings, classrooms, and movement.
What does that even mean? It just sounds like salad, like word salad.
Accommodate needs of children and families at high risk.
Uh huh. It doesn't define high risk. It doesn't define what those.
Well, we know
be.
What high. When policy make when they use terms like at risk, uh-huh. we know that they're talking about communities of color. We know right. that they're talking about Black and Latino low income mm-hmm. students. That's yeah. So consider ways to accommodate needs of children and families at mm-hmm. high risk. So are you just going to send them home and then the white students? I don't know.
Connor, what do you think?
So I think that one of the things that rank and file union members and, you know, parents in the community should really do is keep an open discussion about what it is that's going on, what it is that parents are experiencing, what teachers are experiencing. This is a moment to actually build the kind of partnerships with the community yes. members that has really seen, I mean, that's something that Chicago Teachers Union and United Teachers of Los Angeles have done for years. And it showed when they went on strike and the community was overwhelmingly behind them mm-hmm. because they knew that the unions were striking not for their pocketbooks, but for their kids, for their schools, for quality public education. And so I think this is a moment where rank and file members really need to keep that discussion going and then also engage with their union leadership and say, look, there's, you know, there's support here. There's enthusiasm here that for making sure that we use the power that we have to make sure that whatever is going to happen, it happens in the best interest of the community and of the students. And so I think that it's really something that needs to happen from the bottom up and needs to be driven yep. by members in the community saying, look, we're not going to settle for, I mean, the frightening thing is, and of course, this is different than the 2008-2009 kind of financial crash. But the thing that was most frightening about that is really unions were struggling just to, I mean, they basically resigned themselves to the fact that the public sector was going to get crushed. They resigned themselves to austerity and just tried to mitigate it. Mm-hmm. I think that one of the interesting things in AFT's demands, at least for the plan for reopening, and that can really be driven by, I think, a very changed attitude on the part of the American public, is that people don't seem as willing to just accept austerity as inevitable. And I think that that's really a mood that is really driven by the rank and file, but is even reflected in AFT's document where they're saying, no, like, this is a time where you need to invest more in education. Mm-hmm. This is not a time to cut. Oh, this is a time to spend more.
And every politician yeah. is going to say that, oh wow, we really think education is a priority, and this is a real like, prove it. Put your money where your mouth is. You know, that kind
but
of thing.
But they are spending more money. We just have 287 million that was sent to Louisiana. Mm-hmm. It's just that who is
that money
being
going?
Channeled?
Yeah.
Who is right. that money being channeled through? Like when the I-3 grants came in, invested innovation grants came in, and it was channeled through new schools for New Orleans. And you know, that's why we had these startup charters, you know, in school closures, which really traumatized, you know, children in communities. That it was basically like, let me just throw away, you know, these children and start. Mm. It was really crazy, but it is a time for that coalition building, as you were saying, mm-hmm. Between the parents, the students, and the teachers, and that's what's gonna take.
I'm looking through the AFT document right now, and it says support governor's call for $500 billion in additional funds to meet state budgetary shortfall needs. Because if they don't get that money, they're coming for the pensions, and they're coming for
Looking at that. Yeah,
they're coming for everything if that doesn't happen. If we don't get like this is a situation where that federal fire hose of money that's being blasted towards businesses needs to go towards saving these state budgets so that they don't just rip apart our every single thing that we've built in terms of educational infrastructure and the careers and pensions and everything that the workers have put together and worked
pensions,
for.
I'll tell you that.
They are 100%
at
the pensions.
I'm looking at an email I received today from the Louisiana Retired Teachers Association. Mm-hmm. And it says, just talking about the legislation, it said House Bill 26 proposes amending the Constitution to limit the guarantee of retirement benefits.
Oh,
for
no.
State employees to certain types of benefits. And House Bill 32 recommends adding an optional hybrid retirement plan to the teacher's retirement system.
No, we need to be at the Capitol.
Which I'm a member of.
We need to be at the Capitol right now saying,
both
get
of these
F
bills
out of here.
Authored by Rep. Barry Ivey. Do we know anything about Representative Barry
Ivey? He's bad.
Well, if he's, we have to look
at
these
sounds
things.
Real
so
bad.
They're going after the pension plans. They are,
Yeah, and, you know, Pennsylvania right after used to have an incredible pension system that got, I think, I don't even know if it's three or four tiers at this point, but that really started after the financial crash, and it's going to happen again, even though just a couple of years ago, there was kind of a grand bargain between state Democrats and state Republicans to introduce a hybrid system that was supposed to settle the pension question. Well, you know that it didn't settle anything.
You're settling
now
a question,
it's going to come back.
You're settling a question that you're trying to solve a problem that doesn't, that actually is not a problem. You're trying to create a problem to let me rephrase that. What you view as a businessman from Baton Rouge, which is what this guy is, which this Ivy guy is, right? Your idea of a problem is state expenditures going towards the pension of retired teachers. That's a big loss for you, even though these programs, if they had been allowed or if they are allowed to just exist, are absolutely fundamentally sustainable, right? And but the problem is that right there makes the workers and the people of Louisiana less likely to, or at least less over a barrel in the sense that they actually have a chance to retire. They can actually go home and put up their teaching, their chalkboard or whatever, and live their lives after they've taught for 40 years.
You know, I really love the visual of like teachers hanging up their chalkboards when they retire. I love that. You know, I think
your teaching boots.
Hang up the teaching boots and the chalkboard. I mean, the reality is that the reason pensions have always been a very live issue and mm-hmm. the reason they're going to come back to being a live issue has nothing to do with the viability of pension systems.
No, pension schemes are very, 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 very positive. They always bring in more money than they have intended to do. They do better in investing on the stock market, which is like, we can get into the problems with that, I suppose, on a more fundamental framework level. But what they set out to do, they achieve on that framework, and it's always the first thing that they come for.
Right. And realistically, I mean, taking Pennsylvania as an example, the only reason that there was ever any sort of problem is because Ed Rendell, a Democrat governor who really is, in the Clinton model of Democrats. And I think he was one of the early, he might even be the Pennsylvania chair for Biden's campaign or something. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's definitely involved with Biden's campaign. I mean, Ed Rendell basically raided pension contributions to fund his own pet projects. Mm-hmm. That's the only reason there is an issue. But fundamentally, the reason that this is always going to be a live issue for the right is because they cannot abide more than anything the idea that there is trillions and trillions of dollars sitting around that is restricted in what it can be invested in.
All of that money is not mine.
It's capital mobility. That is it.
Wow.
Yeah. Elizabeth, what you got?
No, I mean, I'm looking at these PPP. I need to find out how much money these charter entities, these charter businesses received in from Small Business Administration. I'm seeing New Orleans College Prep received $1.67 million for they operate two schools. Encore Academy, I don't know much about them. It's one of these new companies. So the money, there was money there. So
tons
I don't
of money.
Know.
Tons. I don't know. I mean,
we just want control of it, and we want to, like you said, we want to invest it.
And we want to make sure that the teachers right. and the workers that are in the place that, like, in the schools, are going to do what the like administration in this sort of like, you know, capital hydra wants them to do. Really quick, let's pause the station ID one last time. You listen to WHIVLP New Orleans 102.3. This is Good Morning Comrade. We're having a very lively discussion about education policy with Connor Lewis from the Pennsylvania State Association of Educators.
Before you say, I'm just representing Elizabeth Jeffers.
Oh, yeah, of course. Everybody here speaks for themselves, not for
anything. Yes, please do not blame my union for my takes. They're very good people.
I will be getting a phone call or an email. No. I'll get an email tomorrow.
Anyway, in the last quarter of the show, last 15 minutes of the show, we've seen the AEI, the American Enterprise Institute's approach towards education. It's fairly bleak. What is an alternative model towards sort of like reopening these schools? And I know the union, like we mentioned the AFT program earlier, what is a safe way to return to schools, and what is education going to look like on the other side of this calamity that we're in the midst of right now? That's a big scary question, but I mean, there's a lot going on there.
So one of the things that I think you have to grapple with when you're talking about adequate social distancing in an education setting is class sizes. And yeah. I just read today that Lori Lightfoot, mayor of Chicago, basically refused to reopen the collective bargaining agreement with Chicago Teachers Union to basically address class sizes as part of what the, you know, 2020-2021 school year is going to look like.
You got 40 kids in a class now. Sorry.
Right. Well, and I went to school in Los Angeles, and, you know, my class sizes, I remember an AP course I took when I was a junior, there were literally 33 people in the room, and the aisles were so narrow that the teacher couldn't walk down them. I mean, that's how they manage to pack kids in the room.
Yeah. You need a shoehorn.
How can you socially distance in that?
Yeah. You need a shoehorn to get them in the room.
Yeah. I mean, I want to try to think positive, because there are a lot of opportunities here in terms of when we're seeing the organizing that's been happening around the country to try to bring different contingencies together, you know. And what I was talking to you about, Jeff, the other day was that, you know, this American capitalist dream, you know, pull yourself up by the bootstraps, you know, what we've seen since the Trump, and we've really seen it for a while, but it's very, very, very in your face. It's always been there, but it's in your face now, which is this whiteness.
All the stuff that was already there, you can sort of like see, like it's almost the loud part is being, the quiet part is being screamed through a bullhorn.
Yeah, I mean, we saw the, you know, we heard about the shithole countries. We've heard about, you know, the Asian flu, you know, I don't even want to use the terminology that they use, but mm-hmm. you know, so it's been very exclusionary, you know, white supremacist, and then basically forcing communities to go back to the schools and put their lives, you know, at risk. So that means much more for a city like New Orleans, where we're actually, you know, capital, you know, Jefferson Parish, like the New Orleans greater area, as well as Detroit. Mm-hmm. Wayne County and Chicago. Mm-hmm. So we have to talk about how different communities are being affected.
Philadelphia, New York.
Right. And they talk about the communities that are being affected in New York, right? Mm-hmm. They just came out that very large percentages, and I don't know the statistics, but in terms of the Latino communities in New York being impacted. And we don't even know what's going on here, mm-hmm. okay, with that.
Atlanta, too.
Well, Albany and like the Albany area has been hit pretty hard, and mm-hmm. that's a predominantly African American area. But we have to look at those things. So what I would like to see, I mean, I see an opportunity to, you know, actually this stuff is not, you know, we're having a crisis in the economy. It's actually not working for white working class or white middle class people either. It's not going to be so. How can we bring them into the conversation of understanding? How can we bring white people into the conversation of understanding how capitalism, you know, is not in their best interest? Mm-hmm. And we need different policies, and we need a different structure, and to understand how white supremacy works and mm-hmm. how they're advantaged by it. So I see opportunities. That's my little intellectual take. Mm-hmm.
Connor? Well, and you know, I think that at least my perception of kind of the public attitude toward public education, I mean, obviously it's been a dramatic reversal just in public opinion toward teachers and public education over the past 10 years. Back when you used to have, you know, Waiting for Superman and Michelle Rhee and all of the education reformers were very deserved boo. When those folks, which
Oprah
really
was
AEI's,
a part of that. We mentioned her earlier, Oprah Winfrey was a huge promoter of that.
Oh God. Yeah. And you know, it was a bipartisan consensus. You mentioned Arne Duncan earlier. I mean, he was as guilty as anyone.
And of course, Karen Peterson, who was also mentioned in the transformation of education in Louisiana. She is the sitting chair of the Louisiana Democratic Party. Go on.
Right. So, who is this?
Karen Carter Peterson.
Oh yes, and her husband was like over, like he's like some CEO for the Recovery School District. He like went into the communities and, you know, under Race to the Top, and oh my gosh, Dana Peterson.
Yeah, go ahead, Connor.
You're 100% right,
Elizabeth. Go ahead, Connor.
Yeah, I mean, this is definitely a bipartisan consensus, and it's one that's been pretty much hammered to pieces over the past. It's still, of course, you know, has clout, but I think as far as public opinion goes, there's a deep skepticism of this kind of narrative of education reform and anti-public school politics, especially on the heels of the West Virginia teacher strike and, you know, the education strike wave. I think that there's really even before this was a much more positive attitude toward public education and toward teachers than there had been, and even teachers' unions, than had existed in decades. And I think that what you see, especially with, I mean, realistically, and I'm speaking especially from, you know, rural Pennsylvania, schools are really part of the community in a lot of ways. And they provide essential social services beyond, you know, just education, whether it's meals, whether it's, you know, psychological support, mm-hmm. et cetera, that social people workers. Are feeling the loss viscerally right now. Mm-hmm. And I think that the response is, I think, on most people's, for most people, is to realize just how important education is. And also you have a lot of teachers that are, you know, really going above and beyond on top of everything that they're doing just to keep education going to support their communities. I mean, I'll admit it. Like, I've been watching videos of just things that my teachers, union members I work with have put together for their kids, and I'm practically bawling. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's what teachers and education support staff are doing for their students right now, and how much communities are feeling the loss of public education right now in a time of pretty much national trauma. I really think that there's a moment here to really fight for public education in a way that we haven't seen in a long, long time.
Mm-hmm. But if you break the school, you break the community. Mm-hmm. So this is something that like it's happening for the rest of the country, but this happened to New Orleans. You know, it's been happening in New Orleans since, well, even before 2005, Hurricane Katrina.
And to sort of like illuminate
take those schools out of the community. Yeah.
And this, and the way that the schools are organized, just before you go on, and you definitely should, but like the part of the thing is that we have no local school districts, so kids can be going all over the city on buses. You know, they can be going anywhere in the city on buses to go to, you know, this school or that.
But we don't have community schools.
We don't have any kind of community based off of that. Go on. I'm sorry, Elizabeth.
No, that's exactly what I was saying. So that this is something New Orleans is, Orleans Parish is, and I'm going to say Orleans Parish specifically, and now they're moving to Jefferson Parish and
they're coming East Baton Rouge.
It's a great opportunity. I'm being sarcastic in saying that, but I know, Jeff, you're dealing with this at your own school.
My school's closing right now.
It's what closing right now. And mm-hmm. And so but you know, the fact that the community came together and fought, and is, we have to keep them that momentum going, even, you know, the stay home order and whatnot, we have to keep that momentum of the organizing going, you know, with teachers, with students, with communities, with pastors, with ministers, because they essentially, you know, it's awful in New Orleans.
To that and point, I mean, you're speaking about something very specific, which was that school board meeting where they decided to close the four schools. We've talked about this a lot on the show. You were one of the folks that were there. You did a great job showing solidarity. And there were so many people, so many folks came from Westwego, North Kenner, from Shrewsbury, from all these places to make sure.
It was amazing. It really, I know it wasn't amazing for you, Jeff, because you're going.
No, it was.
This.
It was amazing. It definitely absolutely was.
I say that because now in Orleans Parish, if you go to a school board meeting, you know, and I can remember in 2010, it was like, this community is fighting for their school. This community is fighting for, and they're all like, they've been pitted against each other. Mm-hmm. So nobody's standing together. And the schools have been, you know, taken from the communities.
So let's make sure that doesn't happen here.
It's definitely been felt much stronger. It's been felt in the Black communities. Mm-hmm. So we have to keep thinking about that. And so, but that's the model that's being used across the world.
Great.
And speaking of Paul Vallis, I'm sure John, you know, these people go around the world and they push these free market, disaster capitalism, white supremacy capitalism.
And Vallis right now is currently a finalist for that state superintendent job, isn't he?
Yeah, he applied for East Baton Rouge Parish School Board. I don't think he's a finalist for their East Baton Rouge Parish. But he is a finalist for the state superintendent position. Yes, he is.
Yeah. So thank y'all so much for joining us on Good Morning Comrade. So anything y'all want to say on your way out, Connor?
Just wanted to, there was a line that, you know, Elizabeth mentioned that really kind of stuck with me. If you break the school, you break the community.
Build the school, you build the community, don't you?
Yeah. And I think that, you know, the hope here is that all of this kind of amazing outpouring of social solidarity we're seeing is going to when we're finally allowed outside is going to prove transformative. And if you build the school, you can build the community. The only other thing I'll do is a shameless plug for, you can follow me on Twitter at the House Red. And of course, give, as Jeff mentioned, we're both on a podcast called Union Thought. So give us a listen, and you can follow us on Twitter at Union Thought Pod, THOT.
UNIONTHOTPOD. Elizabeth, anything that you want to sort of leave us with? Thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it.
That now that I'm in the role of like academia and like higher education and research. So although I come from, you know, I wouldn't even be doing this if I wouldn't have gone through a reconstitution, Katrina firings, and all that. But I just say that how can academics and how can researchers support the work on the ground? And I think that's another opportunity as well. And I think that's something that they did in Chicago when they fought for Dyett High School. I saw that there were researchers on the, you know, everybody was working together and they had a success from my understanding. And also, my Twitter, I just got that started going, EKJEFFERS _PhD.
Great. thank you all so much. I really appreciated the perspective that y'all brought for tonight. Elizabeth, we've definitely been trying to get you on the show for some time, and I'm so glad that you can join us. You can listen to Good Morning Comrade every Tuesday on WHIVFM. You can get more information at WHIVFM.org/listen. Follow me on Twitter at Eminent Prof. Follow the show on Twitter if you're interested at Comrade Morning. And also, you can get more information on the show at goodmorningcomrade.com. Thanks again, y'all. I really do appreciate it.
Thank you. It was a wonderful conversation.
Yeah.
No, thank you. This was great.
Yeah. And all right, listeners, love you. Bye.